I'm still learning myself what we've got. Only last week I found we had a recording of General Armin playing the accordion. Well, had I not come across this by chance, I wouldn't have known we had it. And there's so much in the place, it's been going for 47 years, that anything of a grand, wide sort can't really describe what we do have. People think it's royalty and prime ministers and the war, and that's a bit of it, but a lot of the material is bits and pieces.
Presumably plucked out of the passing moment by pure chance or somebody's shrewdness at the time.
Well, I hope so. That's very nice of you to say that. I suspect that it's like Dr. Johnson says somewhere, that archives is what is left or what survives. It's amazing we have so much. Yeah. But until 1950-ish, when tape came in, we were reliant entirely on acetates and the old-fashioned 12-inch and the 78 RPM.
Well, out of what survives, as you so nicely put it, what have you selected? There's presumably been some theme which worked behind your choice of what you've brought us today.
Yes, I thought I'd try to find some recordings which had not been broadcast before.
What have you chosen first?
Very properly, I've chosen Lord Reith, the first general manager of the British Broadcasting Company, who later became the first Director General. 50 years ago, he was in Germany at the Siemens factory, and he'd gone to see a new recording process.
I never made a gramophone record before. It's rather embarrassing to be confronted with one now. But I'm going to recite a piece of a poem in Scotch, because there are a great many Scots people in Berlin and in Germany. The wee herd. He weebert, he cut a sappy sucker frae a muckle rodden tree. He trimmed it, and he wat it, and he thumped it on his knee. He didna hear the chucket when the harrow broke her eggs. He missed the cragged hern nabbing paddocks and the segs. He forgot to hound the collie at the cattle when they strayed. But you should have heard the whistle that the wee herd made.
Well, he was Mr. Reith then, of course. The voice sounded enormously clear, with great presence. There was another sound which I couldn't quite place, a sort of clicking noise.
The recording is no masterpiece of fidelity, but it has been touched up with digital techniques. We got hold of the recording on a glass-faced acetate disc, and this has been cleaned up to the result you've just heard. It's not bad, because Reith's vitality and vigour come over very well, I think.
Well, that was a world premiere for that piece of recording. What else have we got?
Well, somebody who has nothing in common with Reith at all, I shouldn't think, who they probably met at the time, and it's Stravinsky, who in the early 30s, in 1933... came across to supervise and conduct some of his works with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, recently formed. Stravinsky was pleased with the orchestra and utters these few words, very brief, to show his gratitude and admiration.
Le travail avec l'orchestre du British Broadcasting Corporation m'a toujours procuré beaucoup de joie. Attentif aux sources de son instrument et connaissant les limites de ses moyens, le musicien instrumentiste anglais se trouve en rapport très chaste avec la musique.
Igor Stravinsky, speaking a very precise sort of French in 1933. Why am I surprised that he spoke French, Tony? I suppose that was natural to him, wasn't it?
I think it was the Russian cultural elite who always took French as a natural language. Mm. Stravinsky, too, had lived in France for many, many years after leaving Russia.
I'm amazed we haven't heard it before. But then you've got yet another one, which is new to us in a quite different sense, because I think you're going to prove to us that archives not only saves what happens to have been recorded, but occasionally initiates a recording for the sake of posterity. Is that correct?
That's right. We have the authority, or the finance sometimes, to initiate a recording which otherwise perhaps wouldn't have been made by program makers. When we undertake these recordings, we hope very much that programs will be made of them in due course. And the example I brought with me will come into that category, I'm pretty sure. It is Hugh Lungi, who recently retired from the European service of the BBC at Bush House, talking about his days as translator between Churchill and Eton and Montgomery and Stalin.
He, I think, was far more skillful than most of the people who talked to him, because he would be very clear. He used his interpreter in a perfect way. In other words, he would say one or two sentences, let his interpreter translate that. In the meantime, he was thinking of his next step. With his short sentences, although, as we've said, they might rather ramble and be boring. I mean, in conversation, he was rambling and boring. But in negotiations, he would very much stick to the point. speak in short sentences which eliminated ambiguities and get his point across. That's why I think people have described him in memoirs as being very clear-headed and so on. It's quite true, he was very clear-headed. Whereas other people, even like Churchill, who was fond of rhetoric, of course, would speak at length, would ramble on perhaps for a paragraph, which is impossible for an interpreter doing direct interpretation.
Well, that was Hugh Lungi, who then, I gather, was only 23 at the time he was talking about, describing certain personal idiosyncrasies of Stalin, a man otherwise almost unknown to us.
Indeed, yes. I think the material is fascinating, and I'm very, very glad to have secured it.
Mm-hmm. And presumably there's a great deal more about Lungi's encounters with very important people at that time.
Indeed, there are, and also descriptions of Stalin's treatment of the Russian generals.